Patriots in a noon game. Forecast details now from the National Weather Service today. Cloudy and windy with off and on rain. Some patchy morning fog. Today's high 68. Winds 15 to 20 miles per hour with gusts up to 40. Right now, wind from the south at 10, gusty to 29, 67 in Kenosha, 65 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, of course, is Election Day, and we trust that you have either already voted or are planning to cast your vote before the polls close later today. On today's morning show, we are stepping away from all of that and talking about music and some great musicians. My guest, Larry Ruttman, is a longtime attorney based in Boston, Massachusetts, and he's also a very capable writer with several interesting books to his credit. His most recent springs from his fervent love of classical music. Larry Ruttman himself has very little musical background or training, but he has developed a great love of classical music, and because Boston is such a great musical city, he's had the chance to encounter some great musicians and has even been able to sit down and interview some of them. Those conversations have been gathered together into his newest book called Intimate Conversations, Face to Face with Matchless Musicians. This is a book that in so many ways has been a labor of love for Larry Ruttman.
Yes, this has been a wonderful work to do, for a layperson to do. When you say I haven't had much musical training, I haven't had any musical training, and how did I get this harebrained notion that I could assemble all these people and speak to them face to face and write a book about it? I guess I must be sort of an odd character. Maybe the word is, I would say odd and idiosyncratic. But I did go for it, and I did find all these people. Maybe a little chutzpah entered into it to get them to meet with me. And imagine the five of great American composers in it, wrote handwritten, in this day and age, handwritten letters to me appreciating the conversations we had and how they enjoyed them. And I seem to have a knack, I don't know exactly how, Greg, of drawing people out when I meet them. And, you know, maybe part of that was being a lawyer, part of that is being myself, but I think that I am able to get people to talk about themselves, and these musicians really did.
Right.
I wasn't trying to speak to them about musical stuff per se. I was trying to speak to them as human beings so that the people reading the book could meet these people as people and musicians both, so that they would be drawn to what these great people do, as you know, as a musician. So I'm really interested to talk to you because you are a musician, and I love talking to musicians.
Right. One thing I have to say is, I really appreciate the depth and quality of these conversations, and I think the fact that you came to these interviews not as a trained musician ended up being more of a strength than a weakness, in that I find when I am interviewing musicians, which happens from time to time, that as a musician myself, it is so tempting to kind of go off on tangents or explore matters that about which you really have to be a musician yourself in order to really fully appreciate them. And you kept these conversations on a level that certainly explores some really interesting and significant themes, many of them related, of course, to music, and yet because you don't come to it as a trained and experienced musician yourself, you are, as you referenced earlier, coming to this as a layperson, and the result is a book that is so accessible for the typical layperson who might read it.
Well, you know, exactly, Greg, you hit it right on the nose. I mean, I thought to myself that as a lay person, I could write a book. And actually, there is no other book like this. You know how publishing houses always say, tell us the similar books in this category. I looked and looked, and plenty of books, as you say, about musicians by musicians, but I couldn't find one that went this deep, or even one that went even in a shallow way into the lives of these musicians. And what was in the back of my mind in doing that was in doing this was certainly to talk about music, but as a lay person who loves music, talking about music, not talking in terms of diminuendos and crescendos and a lot of terms that other terms that are a little more arcane that I don't really speak in, but also to disarm people of a prejudice that they have against listening to classical music, thinking that it might be over their heads or you can't understand it. And I think one of the aims I had was to present music to them in a way that they were like they were looking over our shoulders as I talked to these various people. That's how I wrote the book, the vernacular that I used, plain, straightforward, in my own style, but on the other hand, reachable and user-friendly. And then, you know, Greg, a very wonderful thing happened. And I wrote about this in my memoir. That is that when I came to index the book, the indexer suggested that rather than do a plain names index or something like that, I do a general index. The result of that was a 2,500 entry index taking, I don't know, 13 or 15 pages, all about, and every single one of the people in the book got an extensive general index of what they had said, the subjects they discussed, including me, because I also added my own two cents. This was, these were conversations, more than interviews, they were conversations. That's why I say intimate conversations. And the wonderful thing that happened is I suddenly discovered that this book not only is for general readership, but actually probably would have as great or a greater meaning to the academic world, schools from K-8 to graduate level and beyond, as a literary source, as maybe a reference book, maybe even a course book. And I think that with my publisher, Torch Flame Books, I think that's exactly what we're thinking of doing to, because I think the book has a broad general interest. It was an amazing thing.
Hmm. We're speaking with Larry Ruttman and talking about his book, Intimate Conversations, Face-to-Face with Matchless Musicians. It is a collection of interviews, transcribed interviews, which he conducted with various composers, conductors, and performers of various stripes, although generally speaking from the world of what we think of as classical music. And many of them, speaking with him as they made music in one way or another in and around Boston. And is a very, very inviting and engaging book on so many levels. Mr. Ruttman, I don't think we have the time to take too much time with this, but I think it would be interesting for our listeners to get a little bit of an idea about your own relationship with music and classical music in particular. We've already touched on the fact that you yourself are not a trained musician at all, and yet you are somebody who obviously loves music, who supports it. You have attended performances by many of the great ensembles in and around Boston, and I'm sure elsewhere. But tell us a little bit about kind of the where this all stemmed from, maybe originally, and sort of the nature of your love of and interest in music.
Yes. One thing that I want to say even before I answer that question is that it's not just Boston. Many great musicians visit Boston. This book has musicians in it from England, like Harry Christophers, from Germany, like Anne-Sophie Mutter, and from other foreign lands and faraway places in the United States, 21 of these people. So
right, yes. I didn't mean to imply that they are all from Boston. It's just that they have come to Boston, or have at least many of them have very strong connections to Boston for one reason or another as performers or conductors and so on. And it makes sense that these would be at least most of the musicians who, it's no accident that it's these musicians you are speaking to, because you've had the great pleasure and opportunity to directly encounter them.
Well, yes, Boston is a great place for that. They all come there. And the Boston Symphony Orchestra, of course, is a great one. And I started listening. Well, I didn't know much about classical music until I was like 30. Now I'm 93. It's a long time. I started, at 30, I started to become aware of classical music, and I began attending the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And I attended the Boston Symphony many, many times. Their program notes are really extensive. I read them every time, and I went to so many concerts. And I became sort of an amateur musicologist over the course of the time between I was 30 and now 93. So that I think that accounts for, you know, some sort of musical training, but not, you know, musically in the sense that you as a musician would study. And I think that armed me with enough knowledge about music to want to share it with other people. And that really is the purpose of this book, as I said before, to get people to appreciate classical music and to listen to classical music and to find out that it's not off-putting. I might also add that there is pop music in it, so that Willie Nelson is pictured in the book, other jazzers, John Harbison, of course, a great American composer, had operas produced at the Met, but he's also a jazzer. He's been teaching at MIT for 50 years, a great composer. Young guy like Matthew O'Coin, who's only 33, comes from the Boston area, is now having his second opera produced at the Metropolitan. He's a wonderful guy. He and I sat in the park outside of the Gardner Museum in Boston for 2 hours the first day we met, which was in 2017, and we've been close friends ever since. And that's another thing, Greg. A lot of these people became my friends, and we talk to this day all the time. Ben Zander, who has the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra and the Boston Youth Philharmonic Orchestra, just took him to Europe recently. So I've been very lucky in making these associations, and I didn't want to give a pass to pop music, so it's in there. I didn't want to give a pass to women musicians because there's a lot of them in there. And Greg, I know I'm talkative, and you can interrupt me at any time, but I would say that it's been a great life experience and odyssey. One odyssey was putting the book together. Another one is making it appear as the book of my dreams. People pick it up and say, what a gorgeous book. And it's not an inexpensive book, 55 illustrations, a lot of stuff in color. It's beautiful to behold. I only hope that my text holds up with the appearance of the book. But so far, the signs are up because it's received some good reviews already, and I'm very hopeful. Not for money. Not doing this for money. I'm doing it for, thank God, the legal profession, you know, is successful at that. But this is for a legacy, when I'm gone. I hope people will read this book.
You just touched briefly on the fact, and I think I said it in the introduction, that you professionally have been an attorney for at least most of your adult life. I wonder if your experience as an attorney played at all any significant role in terms of these interviews that you ended up conducting. I mean, and I don't know the kind of law in which you have engaged, and sometimes we think of a certain kind of attorney that is grilling people on the stand, and certainly these are not those kind of conversations. But I'm just curious if you feel like any of your experience or expertise professionally as an attorney played any sort of role in how effectively you were able to speak with this vast array of musicians.
I think it had a major role, and I don't think it's one thing and then another thing. I think it's a continuum from legal practice to doing a book like this or other books that I've written. I did practice some trial law. I was an assistant attorney general early in my career in the field of civil liberties and civil rights. I do have courtroom experience. As you said, those are not the conversations we're speaking of. But I always dealt with people. I never knew what was going to happen in the morning. Cases came to me that were notable cases that people could read about in the newspapers here and there. And so I never knew, but I was always ready for anything and had some really interesting cases. And a lot of my work dealt with people, sitting down with them, talking with them, getting them to tell me the whole story, because a lawyer is only as good as he knows his case, and you cannot know the case until you speak closely with a person. So I found, as time went on, that I was able to engage with people in conversation and get them to talk to me. So this carried over, of course, into my career as an attorney. I mean, as an author. And the books I've written are all based on conversations with people. And what I do is I take these conversations, folks that are close to me transcribe them, and when I have the transcriptions, I don't fashion it as a question and answer. I fashion it as a story so that it becomes an intimate conversation, you might say. And I think that that's the secret of, so all my training and all my experience has led to some level of expertise in getting people to talk and then taking what they say and putting it in a form that is not like a notebook, but more like a story. There is no person on earth that doesn't have a story, and I think there are very, very few people on earth that don't like a story. So if when you fashion it as a story, people will pick it up and look at it and read it, and they'll say, that's interesting. And in this particular book, what I'm hoping they do is say not only that it's interesting, but, I think I might listen to some of this. Maybe he's right. maybe it's fun to listen to.
We're speaking with Larry Ruttman about his book, Intimate Conversations, Face-to-Face with Matchless Musicians. One thing I want to say right off the bat, because I don't think I managed to mention it in my introductory remarks, is that although you speak with conductors and composers and performers, you also have a chapter towards the end of the book devoted to music management, which includes a very, very interesting conversation with Mark Volpe, who for roughly a quarter century was the president of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, of course, one of the renowned professional orchestras in America. And among the really interesting conversations as well is one with cellist Lawrence Lesser, who talks in that conversation about being the president of the New England Conservatory of Music for some 15 years. And of course, there are other musicians as well, a couple of the conductors in particular, that are also engaged in the stuff of management. And I appreciate that is here, because, of course, one of the things that can happen when we talk to musicians and talk about music is that we can really neglect the nuts and bolts of what it takes, first of all, to be a professional musician and to run a professional organization that disseminates great music making to the public. From the outset, was it always your intention to make sure that this was going to be an element of your book in one way or another?
Oh, absolutely, because I think music management, as you suggest in your remarks, Greg, is key. And Mark Volpe, of course, was a great leader. And, Mark and I had our ups and downs. I'm not, I say what I want and what I think I should say. And when I met Mark in his office the first time, we had a wonderful conversation. He started off by saying, I got an appointment in 15, 20 minutes. Well, he stayed with me for an hour. And when the secretary said, Mark, you wanted, he said, well, a few more minutes. And we finished that. Later on in our relationship, I won't go into the details. We had a little bit of a difference. But then later in our relationship, and now, because I write back and forth with Mark fairly frequently, and he's very friendly, and he appreciates this book a great deal, now we get along perfectly well. He was the Julian Cohen chair. Now, Julian Cohen was a multi-million-dollar developer who's a good friend of mine and is now deceased in the Boston area, Brookline, Newton, and Boston. And he held that chair. So that was a commonality between us because Julian was an absolutely wonderful guy. So Mark is terrific. And, yes, I think music management is unbelievable. There's a picture in there, of course, of the guy down in New York who's the head of the Metropolitan Opera. And And see, he's an interesting character. I don't know him personally, but yes, Mark is great. And this group of musicians is practically all of them are professors in colleges and universities. And as I said before, we're trying to market this book in the direction of academia. And I think a lot of those people can be extremely helpful, and I think they will be. I do want to say to you one thing. It's wonderful to be able to talk to a musician about this. I never thought in my wildest dreams, Greg, as I got into this, that I would ever be able to enter into the world of musicians in the way that I have. I wanted to write about them, and I thought I could write a book like this, and I did. But on the way, all the practically every musician I spoke to accepted me as part of their world, and I really did enter the world that I couldn't ever conceive that I would enter, not as a musician, but as a good friend of musicians who respected me, talked to me, would write to me, and that's been the greatest. I mean, that's one of the greatest experiences of my life, if not the greatest one. And it's every day I say, what did I do to deserve the grace of God, so to speak, to let me experience something in my declining years yet that I never thought could happen to me? Hmm. That's been, almost otherworldly.
Hmm. We're speaking with Larry Ruttman and talking about his book, Intimate Conversations, Face-to-Face with Matchless Musicians. Your book actually leads off with the conversations that you were privileged to conduct with an array of great living composers. And one of the things that's interesting about that being sort of right off the bat is because I should think in some ways that those would have been maybe some of the most intimidating conversations, mostly in the sense that by and large, musical performers are also people in the public. I mean, in the spotlight, used to engaging with audiences, used to speaking with people at tea parties and so on. And it's, kind of their business to be open and public. Whereas composers, at least much of what they do, is done, at least to some extent, in isolation. And much of what they do is, in a sense, a very private sort of enterprise. And I think composers vary widely in terms of their capacity to really articulate what they do, and particularly to articulate it to ordinary people who are not themselves musicians. That's all a preface to say that I was really impressed with the quality of these conversations with these composers. There's a lot of interesting things here. I wonder, going into it, did you feel a sort of special level of, if not intimidation, maybe just some concerns about how were these going to go?
I would say this, Greg, that, I'm just not intimidated. When you're in your 90s, there are some lucky people who know what they're going to do when they're 5 years old, like Mozart, but other people, just, regular musicians, regular people in other fields. But that didn't happen to me. But over the course of a lifetime, I was always self-confident, but some of it was put on. But as I grew older, it became more natural. My self-confidence became totally real, and I lost any sense of intimidation. I used to be a little bit of a hypochondriac. Then suddenly I wasn't, and I accepted whatever health problems came along with equanimity. I can't really explain. The title of my memoir is something that involves friendship, maturation, and inquisitiveness is in the title. And so I think that I approached all of those interviews like I approached all the others, without intimidation. And the secret, as far as I was concerned, was whether it was a composer or a conductor or anybody, they want to be treated like human beings. A lot of stuff that they go through, they're special people, and people treat them as special people. I think of them as special people in the sense of what they do. I think they're all smarter than I am, but they are special people. But they are human beings, and all human beings have lots in common. And all of us have problems, up, down, marriage problems, business problems, this kind of, I mean, we're people. And if you approach another person as a person, then the relationship is, if you approach a very, very famous person as just another person who, like you, is going to die someday, and, you know, it's a nice trip that we have here, but it has a beginning and has an ending, and you're gone. And if you treat them like that, like you would meeting anybody, it just works better. And I found, talking to these folks, that they would talk to me. Now, for example, Woon-Suk Chin, probably the most famous woman composer in the world today, came from Korea out of bad circumstances, South Korea, and, you know, went to study with Ligeti in Germany, and he and she didn't get along too well, but ultimately she credits him with a lot of her background. She always wanted to write original music, and she has written original music, and she's world famous. Now, when she and I met, when she came to Boston to have the Boston Symphony conduct a premiere of one of her works, we met at a hotel, a very noisy lobby near the Symphony Hall, and we bonded practically immediately because we found that we thought The Marriage of Figaro was the greatest single work ever written by a human being, and we became, you know, Mozart lovers. And then our conversation, I don't know whether you read that interview, but our conversation went on transatlantically for a couple of years, and I didn't see her again until she came to Symphony Hall again maybe sometime in the last year, and I brought a copy of the book to her so she could see it. But we corresponded to, so I wanted to find out, you know, the source of her attitude towards music and what she would write and the desire to write original music. And she's, you know, sort of modest, although she knows exactly who she is. But I think that what I'm trying to say is that we met each other and very soon became Larry and Woon-Suk to each other, and we always spoke to each other as people. And she spoke to me personally about her early years in Korea, so that when you read the story, I think you really do get a picture of her, both as a human being and a composer. And she's, you know, she's not out there, as you say, composers do most of their work alone. So that, but I think those stories of the composers, it doesn't set them off alone. I think it portrays them as people that we share a lot of things with, as all people share things with other people.
Sure. Very good. So, for instance, the very first conversation that you share with us is with the composer John Harbison. And I, for one, know him best, actually, for an opera that was commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera, an operatic treatment of The Great Gatsby. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is that in your interview, you're not shy about saying directly to him that this opera, The Great Gatsby, received mixed reviews. And that's, you know, absolutely true. I mean, and if anything, you know, mixed to negative reviews. I mean, it was not a great success, not widely appreciated or embraced, I think is fair to say, although there's certainly plenty of people who appreciate this work on a lot of different levels. What did it feel like to ask the composer of The Great Gatsby about mixed reviews? And I guess I'm not even asking so specifically about, you know, what you asked him and what he said, but just more in general, what it's like when once in a while in these conversations you are stepping into certain topics that might potentially be a little bit painful for the person that you are talking to. I mean, I appreciate the fact that you did ask him about that, but what did that feel like?
I felt perfectly natural. I'd say this, Greg, that in writing, it's like writing a memoir. What good is a memoir if it doesn't tell the bad as well as the good? When I wrote my memoir, I talked about things in my life that, you know, a lot of people might not want to talk about, but I felt that a memoir couldn't be valid if I didn't tell some of the things in my life that were downers, whether it was a business problem or a health problem. You know, fortunately, most of it was up. But when you read a memoir that's all up, you say to yourself, well, does this person have any faults? Did anything ever go wrong for this person? So that I don't shy away in that interview or any interview from saying things like it got mixed reviews or saying something that has a certain negativity about it, because, number one, it's there and it should be talked about. And number two, if you talk about it, you get answers that other interviewers might not get because they don't bring it up. The person you're asking the questions of is bound to be sensitive to negative things, and if they have confidence in the interviewer, if they, I mean, you might not do it at the beginning of an interview, but as you get into it, and you sort of have a feel for the what's going on, and how and what the and what the story is between the two of you. Are you getting along? Is the person talking to you, or are they shying away from you? Well, when it came to John Harbison, I met him walking down the street with his dog when I came to his house. I never met him before that. And then he and his wife was a great violinist, Rosie Harbison. They took care of me. They gave me drinks. They were extremely nice. And we sat there, and I talked to John for 2 hours. Now, the first hour was pretty straightforward. Then something happened in the second hour where he said to himself, must have said to himself, you know, I can get along with this guy. I like what's going on. And he started to really talk more personally about his music and about himself. And it was in that part of the interview that he really gave me some things that, I don't know, I can't account for all the interviews he's ever had in his life, but I know that the interview went well. He wrote to me that he learned, imagine, he writing to me that he learned a lot from me during the interview. I read that and I was absolutely floored. I said, can't be. This guy is terrific. And he's a very likable guy, and he's a real guy. He and his wife, what did they do? During one of the crises, he's one of those people that if the world were in a state of chaos, he'd come forward and sort of fight for his rights, so to speak. He's a real decent, highly moral, very religious person. Favorite composer is Bach. Has done work at the Vatican for the Pope. Did something over there. John Harbison, and he's written, you know, he's a jazzer. He wrote about baseball. And just a terrific guy. And the picture I took of him, I like that picture because I like the way he looks. And that picture turned out okay. But the answer to the question is, I don't think that any interviewer, I think it's a good thing if an interviewer goes for the negative things because it's a part of life and it should be discussed.
Right. One of the other composers whom you talk with is Joan Tower. And one of the figures who is mentioned extensively in that conversation is the legendary Ludwig van Beethoven. And Joan Tower says something really interesting about Beethoven and, in a sense, the way in which he has been an inspiration to her, but in a maybe somewhat sort of complicated fashion. Do you remember the moment that I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
Share it with our listeners.
Pardon me?
Go ahead and share it with our listeners, if you don't mind.
Oh, well, I mean, first of all, Joan Tower is a fantastic person. She's a very lovely person, a very communicative person, a loving person, and she has her own terrific personality, been a great teacher at Bard for many years. And she spent a lot of time in South America where her father was a geologist, so she told me stories about climbing the wall out of a girls' school where she was while he was traveling around South America at age maybe 15 to get out of the school and go to the nearby Hotel Carrera, sit there, order a Coke, and watch all the people doing whatever they did, and then after that was over, go back and climb the wall and appear in class the next morning at 8 o'clock. So it was wonderful. Yeah, Beethoven, she talked about him in a sense that he was in the room. So I said, you really had an apparition of him in the room? No, she said not that, but I just felt that his spirit was there, and he sort of was in my mind as I wrote some of my compositions, and so I guess she in this sort of out-of-body way had great feeling for Beethoven, and why not? I mean, what a great composer Beethoven is and was. So I mean, it's hard for me to believe that in that era, you know, I was talking to my wife this morning at breakfast about it. I said, you know, Haydn knew. So she said, well, what did Haydn know? I said, well, he was a very great composer and a very great guy, but he knew that Mozart was greater. Like when he said to his father, Mozart's father, he said, you know, your son is the greatest composer in Europe. I said, and I'm amazed, you know, Beethoven, Haydn, Mozart, Schubert. I can't get over that they're all living in and around Vienna at that time. So, but in any event, I guess her muse, all of these people in the book have muses, some dead, some long gone, some alive. But, you know, she picked a good one.
I also especially appreciated your chapter devoted to one of the younger people in the book, maybe the youngest, I'm not absolutely certain, but Matthew O'Coyne, that you've mentioned once before, who has had one opera already done by the Metropolitan Opera and a second coming up in the future. You mentioned that there are 60 years difference in your respective ages, and yet you obviously had this really, really powerful connection with him, and he of course has such an interesting intellect and really, really intriguing ideas, including a moment that I found especially interesting in talking about the music of Mozart. He says something to the effect that there is some music by Mozart that he thinks is better left unperformed in public. That is, there's sometimes music where it's, in a sense, almost tainted when it gets performed and kind of out into the public, versus some music where it's almost better to enjoy it in secret or enjoy it in private. It's such an interesting point that he was making. I wonder if you remember this exchange with Matthew O'Coyne and what you think he was getting at.
Well, you know, Matthew O'Coyne is, as I said before in the conversation, we spent 2 hours talking after a rehearsal. That was the first time I met him in the park adjoining Garden Museum. And we, in those 2 hours, we became fast friends. Right now, I'm underwriting with a friend a chamber piece that's being given in early December in New York by the famous church group, I'm trying to think. They have a great musical organization there. I'm trying to think of the name. And that's the first time I will have acted as a patron for music, and I'm so happy that we're doing it for Matthew, because he really is a wonderful guy, very friendly, and he's a polymath, obviously, brilliant. And at Harvard, he became well-known when he conducted The Marriage of Figaro for one of the houses at Harvard. You know, those performances can be really quite professional when you go to them. I do remember that, but I don't remember it as clearly as some other things. But he has, you know, he wrote a book recently that was published, in which he said that if he had to be left on a desert island by himself and he could only take one piece of music, this keeps coming up, this particular composition, he would take The Marriage of Figaro. That would be the one he would take. Now, what he meant by that, what he meant by should only be performed in private, I say I do remember it, but I remember it faintly. Anything I would say as to what he meant by that remark would be maybe a little bit of a guess, but I think his respect, he's a man of, Matt is a man of such ideas that, you know, he's going to come up with things that are really thoughtful. He might have meant that some of the things that Mozart wrote were so personal that they could only be fully understood in a setting where their playing, the playing of them, was at a personal level, and that a public performance – would tend to go beyond that and would disallow the personal aspect that might be projected when the performance was only for a few people. But that's a guess.
Yeah. I especially appreciate the many wonderful stories that are shared in the book, and one of my favorites comes from the chapter devoted to Susan Graham, a great opera star, wonderful, wonderful mezzo-soprano, who has a lot of great stories that she shares. One of my favorites is when she talks about an experience very early in her life when she was in Shanghai, China, participating in a performance of Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier. And she's talking about, I believe, the very first rehearsal with the orchestra in Shanghai. And she talks about seeing some of these old musicians in this orchestra playing their string instruments, tears streaming down their cheeks. And the reason being that these musicians, for most of their lives, had been forbidden from playing any music from the West, or at least not openly. So here is this moment where some of these older Chinese musicians, for the first time, are able to play this sublime music by Richard Strauss. It's a story like that that really makes you stop and think about some of the things that we are apt to take for granted here in America.
And I hope we still can. I mean, times are very difficult. We don't want to get into too much of that. Susan, I remember that. And I think Susan Graham is a wonderful person. I mean, she grew up like a Texas tomboy. When she came down to be interviewed at the hotel in the Copley Square, a very nice hotel, not too far from Symphony Hall, dressed like a diva, she looked absolutely beautiful. And we sat together for about an hour. We became friends. She just wrote to me a few days ago from Paris, giving me the address to send a gift book to her in California. And she was doing some performing in Paris. Now, the thing that you probably noticed that the frontispiece is the posthumous portrait of Mozart by Barbara Kraft, done around 1815, which is there. It's not my favorite. My favorite is the one that his brother-in-law Lang did from Life. But in any event, I asked her, one of my favorite questions, what is music? So, okay, as I say, you get all sorts of answers to that question. Susan Graham answered me spontaneously, and her answer astounded me, because although I knew by that time how very bright she was and how personable she was, I never expected anybody to be able to say something like this off the top of their heads. I'd like to recite it here. It's not long, but it's on the frontispiece with the picture of with the painting of Mozart. She said, "Life. Music is life. Music is a reflection of who we are as humans. Music tells us things that words can't. It ignites feelings in us that we didn't know we had, and it can reach a depth that nothing else can." I was absolutely floored by the depth, thoughtfulness, and appropriateness of this answer to the question, what is music? And her first word tells it all. Life, a one-word sentence. And I believe that. That's one of the themes of this book, that music is life. And, you know, it doesn't matter whether the humans are here or not. From the beginning of time, music has been life. And it will be when we're gone, until the earth crumbles. And but you know, Susan Graham is remarkable. I mean, I don't know whether you saw recently. She did at the Met. She played the mother, where there previously she had played the victim in that one about the guy that was sentenced to death.
Right, Dead Man Walking. Dead Man Walking.
Yeah, Dead Man Walking. And she was great in that. And I have a special place in my heart for Susan. I just think she's a wonderful person, and she's been, you know, very nice to me, as has Renee Fleming, and that beautiful picture. That's is a story there too.
Right. I'm glad that that chapter is there with Susan Graham. It's a great addition to the book. And that question that you pose to many of your subjects, what is music, received some really interesting answers, including one from conductor Charles Dutoit, who says, don't ask me that question. And someone else wonders if that question is even answerable. But the way in which your various guests grapple with that fundamental question is yet another highlight of your fascinating book. Well, I want to remind everyone that the book is titled Intimate Conversations, Face-to-Face with Matchless Musicians. And the publisher is not indicated in the PDF. Can you remind me and my listeners of the publisher of your book?
Yeah, Torch Flame, one word, Torch Flame Publisher, or Torch Flame Books in California, just near San Diego, Vista, V-I-S-T-A, California. And the publisher's name is Terry Ryder, who has a great name in her own right as a writer and designer of books. And she works with her daughter and also a young woman named Jory Hannah, who's only in her late 20s, who's a marketing manager, who also is a great designer because she designed the book showing those two chairs on the front that everybody looks at that and says, what a great cover! And it is, because it shows exactly what the book is about, two comfortable chairs sort of inclined towards each other. And it speaks intimate conversations, like two people alone talking, having a conversation about whatever, and so it's a very nice organization. I probably should add that my own website has a lot of stuff on it. Larry Ruttman, very simple, LarryRuttman.com. There's all sorts of stuff on my books, on this book, on my podcasts, and on things that have already been written about this book. So LarryRuttman.com is a great place to go. And the book is available now. It came out a week ago on October 1st. And it's you can any bookstore is going to be able to get it for you. And it's been, a lot of things have been written about it. So I'm very happy about it because my hope, as I said before, is that people read it and dip into something that they may not have dipped into before. A lot of these people, John Harbison is one who said that he thinks that classical music will never be, after 100 years or 150 years, it'll be gone, forgotten. I don't agree with that, but that is a big thing, a question out there, because it is so poorly attended in comparison with pop music. That's another issue, but it's been so interesting talking to you, Greg, because you're telling me by your interest in this book and the stories that meant so much to you that, and others have said the same thing, that the book reaches people in a very nice way, and to the person who wrote the book, That's big news, because, I'm the last one who really can answer the question of how's it going over. But when people tell me how it's going over, it's a great feeling. It's nice because, as I say, I want it to get out there.
Hmm. Intimate Conversations, Face-to-Face with Matchless Musicians, the author Larry Ruttman. Thank you so much, Mr. Ruttman. Great to meet you and great to explore your book. Best wishes to you.
Well, I hope I talk to you again. Don't call me Mr. Ruttman. Everybody calls me Larry. I've been calling you Greg, and I want to say that I very much appreciate the time you took to ask me the questions you did, because I can't really imagine that a non-musician would ask me some of these questions, and I really do appreciate the interview so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Tomorrow on the morning show, we are actually preempting the broadcast so that we can continue to carry National Public Radio's election coverage without interruption. But there will be a podcast of the morning show tomorrow. John Meacham talking about his marvelous book, The Soul of America, in which he looks at the history of divisiveness in our country's history. That will be tomorrow on the podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today will be cloudy, windy, with intermittent rain most of the day and a high of 68 degrees. Overnight low of 43. Tomorrow sunshine and 56. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.